Tom Parry.
Matthew Boyle.
Right then. So Nintendo has Nintendo Directs. There's even Pokemon Directs now. Sony's got State of Play. Microsoft's got their own thing, I'm sure. I've heard that Bandai Namco is going to have one. What do you say about us having a Tom and Matt Direct?
It seems to make a lot of sense.
I think so. I mean, as it's clearly been shown in this last week, you don't actually have to have anything to announce. So I think we'd be great. As long as we could talk about games that are literally coming out in the next month or so, I think we'd be fine.
Okay, I've got nothing on my list of subjects that's coming out next month.
Me neither. Okay, this might be more of a struggle than I thought. It's Tom and Matt Attack.
Yeah, I'm not looking towards the future at all here with what the games I've been playing just slightly. Matthew, how about you?
I've been playing some relatively current games. I've also been picking up some bits here and there because we're kind of out of lockdown in Denmark now.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice for you.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, I can't go get a coffee or anything, which I know you guys kind of can.
Lots of
restaurants and everything are kind of still closed, as is the library, as are many other bits and bobs. But like small shops are now open, which is a thing. Which means like I can go to like secondhand shops again, which is nice.
You'd think though, Matthew, small shops, you know, they're more dangerous than larger shops.
You would think so, Tom. But apparently, the larger shops. Are either not open or you need to book a timed appointment to go into them. So, like, small shops are fine where you can't really social distance, but the big shops where you can, they're not open. So, I don't know.
So, we're talking about stuff that's not just purely essentials.
Yes. I could walk into a clothes shop and buy a pair of shoes now. I could... go into a GameStop, if a GameStop still existed here, and pick up a video game. I can go into a second-hand shop and buy lots of PS2 games I don't need, which is exactly what I did.
Have you done that?
I did, yeah. I bought, for example, Sega Superstars, the iToy PS2 game.
Is it in the box with the camera?
It is not in the box with the camera. It is just the standalone game in a case, which is unfortunate, but I mean... It was 5 krona. What am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to leave it there? Am I supposed to leave it there for 50 pence? No.
Do you have an iToy?
Probably. I don't know for certain. Never used it.
Do you have an Xbox camera? Do you have one of them?
An Xbox
360 camera?
I have a 360 camera, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's the one people tend to forget about.
Yeah, no, I
there was an Xbox camera.
I definitely have a 360 camera because I used to play a lot of Uno.
Oh, right, okay. I used to enjoy it with Burnout Paradise.
Yeah, seeing people's faces in rage as they crash
and
into
that,
things.
And that movies one.
Oh, yeah.
You know, where you make your own movies.
Yeah, I remember that. I've never...
You're in the movies,
yeah. That was the one.
Yeah, I think...
It's like precursor to Kinect, but not quite. In those early hazy days of the 360. Yeah, I picked up that. I picked up some other bits and bobs. Like, I went into the charity shop, and there was a big, hunking Danish man, like an older gentleman, which is what I tend to see a lot in the media section of charity shops, and they tend to, like, stand over the records and everything with, like, their arms out to say, like, oh, this is my space. And I just... want to ask them, who do you think you are, Tom? Sorry, that's a really bad MySpace related joke, but they essentially it's the guy from MySpace.
Okay. Tom from MySpace.
God. I know it's bad. Essentially, I went there and like I saw this guy putting games in a pile, like...
Oh, I'll have that. I'll sell that.
The Mark of the Kree, was it? That third person action game for the PS2. Some like random go-karting game. And I was like, oh man, like maybe I should have come here at the start of the day when everything opened. Maybe there would be more stuff. This guy's clearly going to take everything. And then he starts like putting FIFA in his pile and Grand Theft Auto. And I was like, oh no, you have no idea what you're doing. Okay, cool. This is going to be fine. And so he puts this stack of like PS2 games together. That there's actually nothing really there worth a damn, and then just walks away. And I was like, oh, I'll take this Sega Superstar game. Admittedly, this is worth nothing, but I don't have it. And then I looked and I was like, oh, great, cool. A copy of Resident Evil 4 for the Wii for 5 kroner. I'll have that. And there was just some other bits and bobs, nothing really of note, but I was just very happy to get Resident Evil 4 for the Wii.
That's good. I don't own that, as you know.
Yeah, I'd actually, if I have a copy somewhere upstairs, you are more than welcome to this one. But I was just like, oh well, I'm not going to leave it there for 5 kroner. I don't think I actually own it.
Danke schön.
Yeah, I went around some other shops as well, picked up some other bits and bobs. I bought a DS. The red one in a nice Tinkerbell case with a load of games.
I just bought a DSi.
It was
40 need one, but I bought one.
It was 40 kroner. I've been starved of charity shopping, Tom.
Well, you know, I would have done the same.
Is in nice condition.
I don't own a DSi. I've never owned a DSi.
Really?
No.
It seems to be the season of the DSi here at the moment. I found a lot of them recently, which is good, because I want all the colours, because that's what I'm slowly starting to do with the Game Boy colours and pockets now, is going, oh, that's a cheap midnight blue.
I find that they don't keep their condition very well because of their matte finish.
Yes, that is definitely a thing. And when I look at the hinges on some of them, they're definitely like you start to see wear. Also, the hinge seems quite fragile for what is essentially a child's handheld.
So, well, the DS Lite is the best example of that. I've held DS Lites, which are flopping around everywhere.
Yeah,
I've seen a few of my time in games retail.
Oh, I can imagine.
I think they've improved it a little with the DSi. I remember, selling it on that fact. Oh, it's got better hinges than a DS Lite.
But the DS.
But you still want to get accidental damage cover on it.
Oh yeah, exactly. You want to protect your discs, even though they're cartridges, and like the chances of the cartridge going wrong is 10 to none. What else did I get? Oh, actually, one nice thing I also picked up before we actually talk about like things of actual note. I picked up the limited edition of Ni No Kuni, the Japanese DS game that accompanies the mainline one, which comes with a nice little hardcover book and everything else. It's quite a nice package. Just because I was like, well, I can play this in Japanese as a game aimed at children, so there will be lots of furigana, and I can crack into that. Hadn't had the chance yet. Maybe I will put it in the new DSi and take it for a spin. But
yeah, sounds ideal.
It will. I'm sure it will be. Yeah.
Well, I've been getting into the PS1 again lately.
Oh, really?
So I downloaded a couple of PS Classics the other day. Because I'd heard that Toy Story Racer was pretty good on the PS1.
I remember it being okay. It's not very good on the Game Boy Color, I can tell you that much for free, even though it looks impressive.
So I downloaded this, and that wasn't easy. Because for some reason, the PS3 won't let me buy anything directly from a credit card anymore. And I looked it up online, and a few other people have had this issue. There are various ways round it. One of them was to reactivate your PS3 for game purchases or something.
Right.
I think it's to do with how many you've got tied to your PSN network, but that didn't help me in my case. Okay. The only thing I could do was buy a PlayStation voucher off somewhere online and then credit my wallet with that as opposed to using my credit card. So Toy Story Racer was only £1.49.
Wow.
And I tell you what, for £1.49, that's not a bad game. It's made by Traveller's Tales. Yes. I don't know if they did the Game Boy game as well.
I'm not sure. I think someone like Crave did the Game Boy game, but yeah, it doesn't really matter.
It's 3D is very impressive. It's got lovely. It's top tier PS1 graphics.
Yeah.
And animation, big tracks, long, huge tracks. You race around Andy's house, you know, and it's like pretty impressive.
Yeah.
The caveat of this is that there aren't many tracks.
No.
There's about, seems to be like four big tracks, and there's, and the battle arena stuff, they're a bit different, but the battle arena stuff isn't very good. I mean, that will come down to the weapons not being so great.
Right.
There's a couple of good weapons, but yeah, there's a lot of the fire out behind you, and it's very difficult to hit anyone with them. Especially in the, imagine that in a battle arena mode, having to, you know, fire stuff out from behind you.
Yeah.
When you're not in a race, it's quite tricky. But overall, I'd say it's certainly worth $149 should you have a, you know, a Vita or a PS3, and you can take advantage of PS Classics. It's well worth getting, I would say.
I'll give it a look. I'm going to correct myself. Not that anyone's going to complain on this. Tiatex Design Studios from Macclesfield did the Game Boy Color version.
How about that?
I know.
So you say that one's not the greatest?
It's very visually impressive. I think you ended up firing up my copy before I did, and you going, "Oh wow, look at this!" And it being quite, it being like fake 3D on a Game Boy Color.
I've heard it visually. It's, and you know, technically it's very impressive.
Technically very impressive. I wasn't that blown away by the Game Boy gameplay, okay, if I'm honest, from what I remember. But I remember the PS1 game not being too bad.
The PS1 version, it does play well. Carts are quite, it's quite zoomed out. Carts are quite small, but they're really well made and they handle well. So, yeah, worth checking out. I also picked up Cooler World while I was at it, because, of course, that's a pretty expensive game to buy physically.
How much is Cooler
World on that? $3.99.
That's not bad. I mean, Persona's more than that, so.
I think some are like $4.99. Like Vagrant Story, for instance, you know, is a bit more. But still, you know, all of them are rather affordable. But just a heads up, you may have a problem using a credit card. I don't know.
I purchased mine through the Vita TV when I last got my PS5 Classics.
Yeah, because you can't do it through the website anymore.
No, you can't.
Yeah.
No, I knew that. That's why I bought the Sony games before they made them not available.
For PS1 or PSP or Vita.
Yeah, no.
You still buy? Yeah, you can buy PSP. You can play them on Vita, can't you?
You can play them on Vita, yeah. But you can't buy them via their website. Apparently it's just server issues of them trying to update for the PS5 and like trying to keep the store as streamlined as they can, supposedly, on the internet. Yeah.
I wonder if this idea that you can't use a credit card now is it's similar to that of the 3DS, where you can't anymore. You have to have Nintendo points to buy stuff off the 3DS store.
I'm not sure. There is new weird legislation actually within the EU, which is making it difficult for me to buy stuff off my Switch, where I need to authenticate my credit card purchases now, which means you can't like use your saved wallet stuff anymore, which is a bit of a pain in the ass, to be honest with you.
It is a bit of a arse pain.
I have to, generally speaking, I'm having to do the same with Nintendo stuff at the moment, which is really annoying. The other day, for example, when I was literally 2 krona short for a game purchase and I had to purchase a 100 krona card to do it.
Not ideal.
Not ideal at all. Actually, if anyone in your life likes Code Breakers, the crossword puzzle type thing.
I'm not sure if I know it.
So what a Code Breaker is essentially, it's like a crossword puzzle, but essentially at the bottom of the crossword, you have a little grid from 1 to 26, depending on the difficulty of the crossword puzzle.
Oh,
and
right,
each number is assigned to one letter. Mm-hmm. And then essentially a lot. What you need to do is you need to look at that grid and say, okay, 4 is always A. So you fill in all of the 4s on the grid with A's. And then you look at it and you're like, actually, number 3 is Y. So you fill in all the Y's. And then you go, oh, actually, look at that. There's a 3-letter word there and an A and a Y. I bet you that number 1 is an S. And then you write that and then you fill in all the S's and you see if you're correct. And that's generally how you do a code breaker.
Okay. I think I actually have come across these at some point.
I'm sure
point, but
there are a lot of papers. I remember seeing them in like the Metro and everything else. My mum is super into these puzzles. Like, she buys code breaker books. Because of that, I was like, oh, I wonder if there's anything like this digitally that I could try, or maybe good for her as a thing, because I'd played the 51 worldwide games and I thought, oh, well, maybe my mum would enjoy this. Maybe this is something...
Oh, the Switch.
Yeah, that she can she can mess around with and play some various games to pass the time in lockdown. I was like, oh, I wonder if there's code breakers. And there was. The version on the Switch at the moment is actually, I think if you just search Code Breakers, I think it's the only one. Ironically, it literally come out the day of me saying, I wonder if there's a Code Breakers app.
It was meant to be.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not bad. It was quite fun. I'd never really done Code Breakers before, but I kind of messed around with it a little bit. The interesting thing for me was there was it's 1,000 Code Breakers, both in English and Japanese, and I was like, oh great, I can do a Japanese code breaker. No, I can't. Japanese code breakers are really hard, it turns out, if you don't understand Japanese that well, because how it's done in Japanese is somewhat similar to how it's done in English, in the fact that everything is broken down into katakana. So I guess that's how they do Japanese crosswords. So instead of obviously writing kanji for things, because then it wouldn't really be a crossword, you write how things are spelled out phonetically.
Yeah.
And so that requires you to obviously know that a U and a ki means snow. And it's a level of abstraction that my brain just can't...
I imagine that's quite tricky.
It's like I translated a children's book yesterday, because that's how I roll on a Saturday night in lockdown. And it was Momotaro, which is a traditional like Japanese children's tale.
Okay.
And because it's a children's book, it's all in short form Japanese, which I'm not great at. And it's all in hiragana because it's a children's book. And it took me a lot of having to type. Like, I could read it fine. I could read it out loud, okay. And the pictures obviously gave me context, and I was able to say, like, sen, and I was like, oh, boat, because they're in a boat. Great. But it was more difficult than I'd imagined it to be to kind of strip it back from kanji. And as a result, I couldn't do these code breakers, which is a shame. And I couldn't even really... I didn't feel like when I did the first two or three of them, which literally have two katakana, and so it's literally trial and error, flicking back and forth. Even when I got it right, and I looked at the words that were there, it would be like you say or something, and I would Google what the fuck does that mean, and then I'd look it up, and it means like grave disappointment. I'm like, oh, I'm never gonna know this word. This word is not as easy as the English word, because they need to be short and using the same katakana. So I imagine Japanese crosswords are a lot more difficult. Anyway, if that sounds like your thing, pick up the English.
I applaud your, God, I've been sitting here thinking, I know exactly what to say when Matt finishes talking. Perseverance is the word. I was thinking, what's that word? What's that word? I want to tell Matt I applaud his, what is it? Perseverance.
Thank you.
And now I've just turned that into a big thing. Let's move on.
It's okay. I'm going to get that. I'm just going to put Tom appreciates my perseverance printed out and put it on my fridge. It's fine. It'll keep me going. Yeah, so other than that, really, I beat Persona Strikers, Persona 5 Strikers.
Now, you finished that relatively quickly.
I did. Oh, well, so I should mention, I can't remember if I did at the end of the last podcast. The reason there wasn't a podcast last week was because I had an operation on my nose. Nothing like serious, but it meant that I was...
You had a nose job.
I had a nose job. No, I didn't. I have a deviated septum, so I got it corrected finally. Because, you know, breathing in the times of a COVID pandemic seemed like something that was probably a good idea. Anyway, got that done. And essentially, I couldn't really move around too much. I was told specifically, you should sit in a chair, generally sleep as much as you can, because what would happen was I would get up, my body position would destabilize, and I would just bleed from my nose. It was essentially the uncomfortable truth of it. And so that was a great time to just sit in a chair and play through a game that I really wanted to play. So I played through all of Persona Strikers under the guise of bed rest, which was nice, because it was... It's a game that you can play at pace, because obviously there's visual novel aspects to it with a lot of the back and forth with the characters. And generally speaking, that just means you can just let the controller lie for a second when you're like, oh no, I need to actually get a tissue because I need to deal with whatever the hell's going on up here with my nose.
Yeah.
And the combat system, being a Misha game, like a Dynasty Warriors or a Hyrule Warriors or any other Warriors game where you just go into a big arena full of enemies and just bash them about, is relatively stress-free. So it was definitely a good game. It was one I will now associate with that recovery period, but one I very much enjoyed. It is very much a sequel to Persona 5, in that, yes, it does reference some stuff likely of what happened in the previous game, but it is very much, as was Dancing All Night, the Persona 5 rhythm game, it's very much a, hey, you know these characters very well, we're going to build a bit more character development into them. And it was very much, like I said on the last podcast, it was very much like hanging out with old friends, because these characters are so well written and so well defined that I'm more than happy to play any adventure with them, and it was actually kind of nice. Especially weird during a pandemic where I've not really seen that many people, you know what I mean, to like go back to characters that I quite liked playing video games with before, and then just being like, oh well, it's really interesting to see these people have a life and all the stuff they're doing, and
like how, they're real people.
Like they're real people, and how that actually evolves, which is, you know, a complete opposite to something like WandaVision, which is the other thing I've kind of been watching during this period. No, it's very good. The Musha style combat here feels very much more like an action game than it does a traditional Musha game. Like I've played many Dynasty Warrior things. I've never played any of the modern ones. It's made me curious to check out the One Piece Musha game they did a couple of years ago, because I'm like, okay, there maybe is something enjoyable in this genre if the characters are right, so maybe I'll try it with One Piece. The difference is it does bring in the Persona style weakness system, like the rock, paper, scissors thing that's prevalent in a lot of JRPGs, where, you know, there are enemies that are weak to lightning, there are enemies that are weak to fire, and so
yeah.
You use your different personas, like, which are essentially like Pokemon, and you capture them at the end of battles. Not capture is the wrong word. You defeat them, and then you can pick up their mask, which allows you to use them in combat. And from there, you level them up and you merge them together to create new personas and everything else. And while you're doing that, depending on how you've leveled them, you can take certain skills and certain attributes from the parent personas, for lack of a better word, and then fuse that into the newer, more powerful ones, so you can kind of keep your leveled progress. Mm-hmm. That adds an interesting dynamic to it. It's all done on the R1 button, where you summon your persona, and then you can, like, I don't know, Jack Frost, the mascot of Atlas, the little jester dude with the little bell hat, is ice.
Yes.
And so you would use the ice move with him, and then that would exploit a weakness, which would mean the enemies get stunned momentarily, so you can quickly pile into them. Essentially, you press like circle and it does a all-out attack, and like everyone flies in silhouette-y form that's very reminiscent of Persona 5. It's kind of cool, but I did realise as I got later into the game that you have a party, and obviously you use Joker, who's the main character, quite a lot, and you can switch between the other cats, members of Persona 5, by using the D-pad. So at any time you can bring in Makoto or Anna or Morgana or any of these characters, and they all have slightly different fighting styles, the same way you would, I guess, now experience in a traditional Musha game. But I realized, oh, actually, if I use someone like Makoto, who's a lot faster, I don't really need to use a lot of this elemental weakness stuff, because she's dealing as much damage by how quick she is with her fists, and I don't have to use MP.
So that becomes a bit redundant.
So it does become a bit redundant towards the end. However, I must point out, I was playing it on normal difficulty. I'd imagine if it was something like hard or the insane mode that you unlock at the end of it, I imagine that elemental weakness stuff would be a lot more intrinsic to the gameplay in the way it is in Persona 5. Because in Persona 5, it is literally sometimes life or death, you exploiting an enemy's weakness. Because if you, for example, are fighting demon characters and you can't exploit their weakness to stun them, they're generally probably going to cast like a one hit kill move on you, so you need to do that stuff actively. Whereas you don't necessarily here, which is a bit of a shame, but like I said, it could be down to the difficulty and the fact that this is a Musha game rather than a JRPG where you can sit there and plan all your moves. I think it needs to be a bit more fluid, which is good. There is also a new character introduced. Annoyingly, a lot of the charm of Persona 5 and what kind of gets in its own way a little bit, as you will experience a bit in playing Persona 4 Golden, is that the games are very much about bonds with characters and all this, and there isn't really that aspect to this game. There isn't any like side missions where you go and talk to people that much. You can go on a date once or twice, but there's not like the dating sim aspect to it. There's not you meeting up with some of the side characters, like the guy who runs the BB gun shop, and you develop your bonds, you can get better weapons, or your teacher, or the doctor lady. You don't really do a lot of that stuff. It's very limited down to your party and their story. It's essentially you're touring Japan, and you get to see lots of different areas of Japan. That's a bit of a shame, but it does introduce a new... It does introduce a new character who's very interesting. I don't really want to spoil the game. Slight spoiler for 10 seconds. A new Phantom Thief. End spoilers. A guy called Zankichi, who is a cop who's investigating the Phantom Thieves. And he's a very well-written character. Persona has this thing of introducing adult characters that are either on the sidelines watching you and being slightly judgmental, but you can kind of work around them with the bond system to make them like you, or their enemies. Like, the main bad guys in all the Persona games are essentially politicians or, you know, corrupt officials and all of this kind of stuff. And it gives you a police officer who is not only relatively likable, but he is actually turns out to be quite a well-defined character, and he is an adult, and he does actually understand these teenagers and what they're trying to do, even though he thinks they're a bit naive. And I was like, oh, this is really refreshing. This is actually kind of a new direction for them to maybe pull in Persona 6, where it doesn't have to just be a load of high school students. Maybe it can be a larger swath of diverse characters, which is really cool. I was like, okay, I'm down for this.
When you talk about this game, I can't help thinking Scooby-Doo.
I mean, yeah. I mean, there's the gang of teenagers solving mysteries. But I mean, I think Persona 5 is an incredibly well-written game. Yes, it does kind of have the same issues that I talked about with Like a Dragon, where, you know, it will be about strong female characters, and then there will be like weirdly pervy situations that they kind of throw them into, which kind of undermines that a little bit. But there's less of it here, I think, than in the Persona 5 main game. But yeah,
I think you've got to expect that from maybe a Japanese video game.
I think so, yeah. But it's very well written. In spite of that, that stuff is at a minimum. It's there, obviously, because it is what it is, but it's kept at a minimum in a way that I'm like, okay, actually, maybe this series is maturing in a way that this perhaps won't even be that prevalent in Persona 6 or the new show.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like to generalise. I don't think it is a factor in every sort of Japanese story-based action-adventure game which features prominent female characters. For example, maybe Shenmue's a good example of that.
Yeah, I would say so.
Well, Joy's a bit sexualised, but, yeah. But that is the whole of the debate.
It is. Anyways, the overall...
I just had to mention Shenmue, by the way. That was the only reason.
It's okay. That's why I just mentioned Like a Dragon, because I had to get a quarter of mentioning it once per episode. It's really good. That's all I can say about it. There's no negatives for me. Yes, the elemental weakness stuff is not the best implemented, and maybe this should have been a Persona game, but I'm actually kind of glad that it isn't, because it lets you experience what is essentially a sequel to Persona 5 in like 30 hours as opposed to 100 odd. If you were like me and you were like, oh, should I play Royale first? Because there's characters in Royale. No, you don't need to.
No.
That I'll save you that 107 hours, apparently, Royale is, in that none of the new characters, the new female protagonist, or the adult doctor guy who works in the clinic, they are not in this game at all. They're not even mentioned because this is seen as a sequel to Persona 5 Original. Don't get me wrong, Tom. I wouldn't be surprised if we see a Persona 5 Strikers Royale at some point that introduces those and fixes those.
Quite possibly, yeah.
But if that happens, I'll gladly play it again, because to be honest with you, it was a very fun game. I really enjoyed my time with it, which is, you know, in this day and age, Tom, where I can be quite critical of games, as you know, I'm very pleasantly surprised. It's like a 9.5 out of 10. It isn't a perfect game, I don't think, but it's probably the closest I've come to playing something that I've really enjoyed and have no reserves about for a very long time.
That's excellent. That's a glowing review.
Yeah.
But you would say, if I'm correct, that it's not something you should play if you haven't played Persona 5.
I don't think you would get as much out of it if you haven't played Persona 5. I think it would be a good Musha game. Let's be honest, at this point, there is a Dragon Quest Musha game, there is a Zelda Musha game. I'm sure there is a Musha game that either is of a similar level of quality, that is in a world you enjoy, or give it a couple of years, and I think some of the learnings that they've taken from this game in particular will start to surface in those other games. So,
Okay. So Persona 5 fans get it.
Persona 5 fans definitely get it. Honestly, I personally think that the story is better than Persona 5, if I'm being totally honest, because it doesn't... It's funny you mentioned Scooby-Doo, because there's a weird Scooby-Doo style, like, oh, this plot point, this reason for why we figured this out doesn't actually make any sense, and it's really convoluted, but we're going to explain it anyway thing that reminds me a little bit of Scooby-Doo, but... Persona 5 Strikers, hell of a game. Check it out. Play it.
Excellent. And if you were interested in maybe getting into Persona 5, Royale is on sale for about £12 on the PS4 at the minute.
And that, I'm sure, is a great way to play that game. I think those extra characters are quite well loved in the Persona community. I will eventually get round to it, Tom, because from the sounds of things, we're not going to have any video games for the next 5 years through speculation I've heard on other podcasts. So let's see.
What?
I'll talk about it in a minute. It's fine.
Okay. Well, I've still got plenty of video games to play. So, I mean, I'm in no rush for new games. I've actually been picking up a few older games as of late. I mentioned earlier about getting back into the PS1. I picked up another PS1 game, which you'll certainly be interested in hearing about, Matt, because we've spoken about it off the podcast recently. And that game is Shoot.
Oh, really? You picked that up?
I picked up Shoot for... I'm going to do a little thing in this section. I'm going to ask you how much you think I paid for it. So all these games are bought off eBay. How much you think Shoot on the PS1, published by Phoenix Games, might have cost me?
Ooh, right. So Phoenix is a weird one where some stuff from Phoenix can be really expensive and some stuff can be really cheap. I'm going to go around the £15 to £20 mark, because that's generally what the more average cost of a Phoenix game is now.
Well, £6.
£6, that's all right. Wow,
that's actually... right. You can buy sealed copies for about £12.
Wow, this is a relatively affordable Phoenix game. That's really interesting. Now Tom, before this podcast goes out and we ruin that, is it any good so I can quickly buy a copy of eBay?
Yes. Is it any good? Well, the best thing is the prototype Dead Eye Jim, which is present on Shoot. Now, it looks like... It makes Dead Eye Jim look like a HD remaster remake.
Oh, really?
Essentially, it's the same thing. I don't think, from memory, it looks quite as nice as Dead Eye Jim or, you know... I think Dead Eye Jim also has a few more gameplay mechanics. It's a bit more interesting. It's a stripped-back, simpler sort of prototype of that game.
Yeah.
But the rolling's still in there.
Right. That's good.
Dead Eye Jim is a gallery shooter where you play as a cowboy who's shooting at bad guys popping their heads out of windows.
Right.
In a third-person perspective, for those who haven't played it, you have two guns, you know, so that's always cool. And that's the best thing on it. But it's not just the Wild West-themed game, as that one is.
Yeah.
There is the... there's a spaceship one, which is you're basically flying a spaceship over some water or different... there's different stages, but they're all essentially the same. And you shoot stuff. You've got missiles. You have to pick up fuel and rockets to refill through little power-ups. It's difficult sometimes to see what you're shooting at because your ship's so big it sort of obscures what you're trying to shoot at.
Yeah.
And there are several variations of that. It's a spaceship, there's a robot, there's a fighter jet. So you can replay that same game with several different skins.
Right, okay.
There's one where you're inside like a mech and it's like first person. But it's essentially the same thing. You've got other mechs floating around and you try to shoot them. But there's so much bump on the screen that it's hard to see the things you're trying to shoot at.
Okay, I hate when that happens.
Okay. I think they're all the ones I've played. I think there's two more that I haven't played yet, but I assume they're, you know, just different versions of the same thing. The Western one, which essentially Dead Eye Jim on the PS2, is the most unique, most enjoyable one on there.
Yeah, which is probably...
I don't want to give it too much praise because it's a very simple game.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
That's what you get for shoot. So is it worth going out and picking up a copy yourself? Well, the good news is it plays well.
Yeah.
Apart from that, obviously, the
visual
vehicles
mess.
Being...
The
graphics are good. I mean, it's quite accomplished graphically. It flows very well. It's the simplest kind of game. You know, you shoot stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's reflected in its title.
Exactly.
I mean, it's very appropriately named. If you just want to shoot stuff, either as a spaceship, a cowboy, or a fighter jet, or a giant robot, then this is the game for you. But if you want a bit more... then, I don't suggest it. But
okey-doke.
It has a very striking cover, which you've probably seen, Matt, having looked it up.
Yes, I have. I'm looking at it right now.
A very angry man and the word shoot written quite large in papyrus.
Yes, which is the one thing that struck me when I saw it. Years before Avatar as well, I guess. When did Avatar come out? Avatar was...
Why did you mention Avatar? Oh, papyrus. Right,
yeah. Papyrus! Sorry, there's an SNL sketch. If you haven't seen it, you should check it out with Ryan Gosling. It's very funny. It's really strange to me to see this game with papyrus on the front. It's really random, but hey, so
but
it goes.
I had no idea this existed. I thought Dead Eye Jim was a one-off, and I didn't know that it's sort of at least the basic gameplay and, you know, the whole concept came from this PS1 release.
Yeah, which is really interesting. I'm curious to play this with robots. And I'm going to pick this up. You know what, Tom Parry? You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to buy it now.
How much?
Whopping €3.
Oh, really?
Yes.
That's great. Have you got the manual? Don't bother, the manual's very thin.
It does have the manual.
Yeah,
I'm not gonna buy a copy without the manual to save myself €1. That seems a bit redundant.
So there you go, shoot. So I picked up another PS1 game.
Right.
Rage Racer.
I have Rage Racer.
Hmm. Well, I'd never played Rage Racer. And as a fan of Rage Racer, I thought, well, there's a gap in the collection. I'd be quite keen to try it out.
Yeah.
Have a guess how much I paid for Rage Racer.
Probably not very much. It's a PlayStation 1 racing game. I'm going to say absolute max £10.
13.
Ooh.
You can't get a copy of Raid Racer on eBay, at least, for any less than that.
Really?
Currently.
PS1 games are on the rise right now. I'm very surprised that something like Rage Racer is even that price.
Yeah, which is a common popular game.
Very common, very popular game. Yeah, very interesting that that's so expensive. I wouldn't have imagined that.
I've heard it has a more realistic tone and feel than Ridge Racer, which is more bright, colourful and arcade style. Yes. Whereas Rage Racer, they went for a slightly darker, grittier approach.
I had always assumed that Rage Racer was more a response to things like Gran Turismo and trying to get more of an essence of realism into their racing games. But I mean, I own a copy just because I think I bought it with a PS1 and a load of other games I wanted. But I don't think I've actually played Rage Racer.
No. Well, I look forward to giving that a go, and I'll certainly talk a little bit about it on the podcast once I've done that. I also picked up Tocobot Plus for the PS2.
I had a copy of that that you could have had.
Or Tocobot. Tocobot, okay, well, yeah. It cost me £7, that one.
I think that is a game that I have picked up a couple of times in what was originally when we would go to, like, GameStop. Because it looked interesting, and I think I've picked it up like two or three times by accident. But I have never
originally
played it.
A PS2 game.
Yeah, and then it was PSP.
Sorry, not PS2, PSP. Yeah, that's what I meant to say, yeah. But it struck me as a interesting platform adventure game.
I vaguely remember putting it in the PS2, testing if the disc worked, and going, oh, this looks quite cool, I'll come back to this. And much like every other PS2 game I bought at that time, I never did.
Seems to have some unique mechanics about it.
Okay. Let me know how it is. I'll take it for a spin myself, maybe, and see how it goes.
Shall do. I'll leave my pickups there for now, and we'll talk a little bit about the rest of my pickups next time, I think.
Okay. To close off mine, I did actually pick up a copy of Speedball for the Master System, because it was 20 kroner. And I also got... Dog's Fashion for the Game Boy Advance, boxed for the same price.
Wow.
I know. Surprisingly, seems to be somewhat of quite a rare PAL release, but it was £2, and I was like, well, it's a boxed Game Boy Advance game I don't have for £2. That's a kind of a rarity in these days, so I grabbed it. I also got E.T. for the Game Boy Advance, which I haven't had the pleasure of taking for a spin yet, but I imagine probably not very good based on the other E.T. games I've played.
I think that was released around the time of the re-release of E.T.,
yes,
was it not?
Yes, there was. Yeah. There's also like 3 Game Boy Color games, so I imagine is the highest degree of shovelware, if I'm being totally honest.
I would expect it's probably better than the Atari original
E.T.
game.
I don't think that's very hard, but it is also developed by a company that I hadn't heard of, and their logo is just essentially a rainbow font. And so I'm just like, okay, this is probably not very good.
Although saying that about that Atari game, I think it does have its fans, and it was quite a unique concept.
Well, I mean,
maybe it just rushed out. It didn't have, like, it wasn't in development for very long at all, was it?
2 weeks or something like that, if I remember the story correctly. It's a bit bonkers. But yeah, it's a really ambitious game for what it tried to do. But it's really, really ill-conceived.
It needed more time. Go on, Matt. What else have you been playing?
I've been playing some more of Sakura Wars, and I'm afraid to say that even though I am slightly more favourable things to say about Sakura Wars right now, after just playing a combat section, the game is very tropey. I know it is a dating sim at its heart, but like the dating simness of it at the moment outweighs the combat stuff, and the combat stuff is not that great either. As I said on the last podcast, it's very Musha, but it's not as definitely nowhere near as good as Persona 5, and I think perhaps that has coloured my expectations a little bit as to what a Musha game can be, and now I'm like, this is even not as good as I thought it was going to be. I just can't get over how tropey the story is my main concern. It is...
Cliched.
Oh, God. It is, like, is the most cliched thing I've played in a long time, and is very convoluted. I was trying to explain the storyline to my wife, because she was like, why is the girl so short? And I was like, it's because I think she's a teenager, but you're a captain. So, for example, right, like, I had to as part of the storyline, because... all of these government things that fight these weird demons that are invading Tokyo are, like, undercover for some reason. They have, like, secret bases. I don't know why they need to, but they do. And the secret base of the Flower Division, which is the one you are the captain of, is in a theatre, as I'm sure I mentioned last week. So, like,
oh yes, yes
all of what you're doing is the side quest stuff that isn't related to combat is very much like, oh, we need to run this theatre very well. And so you get in a girl who is a very famous actress to be a part of your theatre, and you force the bookish European girl to write a script because she's so into books that she must be able to write an award-winning script. And at one point during that process, you need to go on a date with the girl who's writing the script because she's never been on a date because she's shy and insecure, and you... It's just so convoluted. And, like, I was trying to explain this to my wife, and she's looking, and she's like, oh, this is really bad. And, like, my wife loves trashy romance stuff. Like, she will watch that on Netflix any day of the week, but she was like, this is not very good, is it? I was like, no, it isn't. And so I got through that stuff. I'm on the second chapter. There's only 7, so it's not going to be that much more to push through, I think, if I want to beat the game. Because combat stuff is enjoyable. Like, there is some cool stuff to combat, but it's just not... It's not at a level of polish that I would kind of expected it to be. And there's just so many tropey things going on that I really can't recommend it. I did actually purchase, though, a high-grade Bandai Namco model kit. I don't know who you call Gunpla when Gunpla isn't Gundams, but it's a model kit of the main Mugen, which is like the robot from the Sakura Wars franchise, because I think the armor design and the game looks incredible. It's really nice looking, and I think a lot of the care of the detail into environmental design and everything, and especially the robot design, is really cool. I just don't think it's that strong a game, to be honest with you. And regarding how loved the rest of the Sakura Wars franchise is and how lukewarm the reception of this game was, makes me think it's probably not the strongest entry into the series anyway, even if they were trying to break away from what it had traditionally been as an RTS game. So I don't know. Maybe I'll go back and play one of the other two. The Dreamcast
still
games,
feeling lukewarm towards Sakura Wars.
If anything, I'm feeling slightly cold towards it at this point, I think. Like, the new and shininess of it is definitely worn out. It's welcome, and I can kind of see... I can't really bring myself to get past the flaws of it all, which is a shame.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that sucks a bit. I've been playing something else this last week. Actually, yesterday... I decided I'd sit down and finish off Dead or Alive 6 story mode.
Really? So you spent 3 hours then sat in front of a computer. Good for you, Tom.
So, Dead or Alive 6, I think I'd played up to chapter 5 previously.
Yeah.
I'd say the whole game story mode takes about 2.5 hours.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, it's not very
long. To play through. Most of that time is waiting for the loading.
Yep. Can't argue there.
It likes to sometimes load cutscenes, I mean, to boot you back to the menu before you've even had a fight. You know, some of the chapters are just cutscenes and there's no fight involved. It would be much better if it seamlessly moved from cutscene to fight, without taking you back to that main menu. Because that's the loading is, most of the loading, basically.
Yeah.
So this is a major hindrance, which is alleviated if you're playing it on one of the next-gen machines. At least I know the series consoles eliminate the load times somewhat.
Yeah.
So let's look past that and talk about the story for a moment. I don't think we covered this in any detail when you played it.
No, to be honest with you, I think I just kind of went through it as quickly as I could, and that was pretty much it. Like, I didn't dwell too much on the story because there's not really that much there.
Well, what's interesting is how it's split up. You can play through it sort of the main points of the story, and then you can play through the different characters' perspectives on that story. So it's set up like a timeline.
Yes.
So you can complete it, but if you want to get the full story, then you have to do the separate missions.
Yeah.
Now, there's one mission I can't do because it's locked to a character I've got to purchase.
Really?
Yeah. So they must have added this later. So I've actually got Mai from King of Fighters. I downloaded her so I could play her chapter, but I haven't got Cooler, who's the other King of Fighters character. Now, you need her to do her story mission.
Oh, interesting.
Which I don't know. It's probably just one fight, one cutscene. Probably. I imagine.
I don't think Mai was in the game when I completed it. So that that's interesting that that's a new and updated thing that you need to purchase.
Yeah. But the story is a bit of a joke. There's not much there, really. It's your typical Dead or Alive fare.
Yep.
With big explosions at the end and making some sort of creature in a lab. They're resurrecting Raidu, who was a villain in another Dead or Alive game, yes. I think. Along the way, they have to kidnap Honoko, is it? And Marie Rose.
Yes.
For some reason. Then you find out that more people are related in Dead or Alive than you thought were related.
Yeah, everyone, like, everyone is.
Kuroko turns out to be Helena's sister, which is like a totally throwaway thing, which only get mentioned briefly.
Yes.
And doesn't seem to have any, you know, effect on the story.
I would argue has no effect on the story whatsoever. I mean,
you also find out that Honoko is Ayane's sister as well, in one line, and which it's like, why do all these characters have to be related? It was it not enough to have Ayane and Kasumi as half sisters, and then find out that Hayate is Ayane's half brother.
I have forgotten who half of these characters are, if I'm totally honest. But yeah, I just remember there lots of reveals about, oh, I'm your sister, and I was like, okay, cool. Like, is this so people can just ship these characters? I don't understand it.
I really don't get that aspect of the story, but it's a fairly simple story. I mean, it has a couple of moments in it. There's a whole thing with Rig. Rig being a character in Dead or Alive 5, who's friends with Bass, they work on oil rig together. Yeah. Who gets taken over by an evil energy. Christy and the new character Nico are working together in this lab to resurrect Raidu, and for some reason they need to brainwash what's his face? Rig. But probably just so you have another enemy character to fight against.
Yeah.
But then I think Rig is related to Donovan, whoever Donovan is. Is he the scientist?
Donovan is like the main guy behind the corporation thing from Dead or Alive 1 and 2, right? Like, that name rings a bell.
Doatech.
What? Yeah, wasn't Donovan Helena's boss? Or
no, I think that's Fame Douglas.
Oh, God. Is that I have no Fame idea, Douglas, Tom. Who's... I don't know the lore of Dead or Alive as well as I should.
It's such a mess. And you also find out that Nico has resurrected Helena's mother.
Yes, that bit was just...
Who got shot in Dead or Alive 2 by Ayane, who assassinated her for some reason. Oh, Dead or Alive is such a mess. It's such a soap opera-y mess. But it's still kind of entertaining. But don't expect much substance there.
No, there's not a lot of substance there at all.
I'd like to hear Dead or Alive storyline explained by a Dead or Alive expert.
I'm sure there are many YouTube videos you can watch, Tom, and many of them have jiggle physics on them. Never mind. It's okay.
You do unlock encyclopedia entries. There's a mode in the game, DOA Encyclopedia, so if I wanted to, I could, you know, read up on that and find out exactly what's going on.
I would argue, Tom, there's probably some better uses of your time, if I'm totally honest.
You don't even get an achievement for finishing the story mode.
No, I was very disappointed to find that out. I was like, did I miss something? But no, I didn't.
So I've actually got a lot of achievements on the game. The stuff that I'm missing is mostly related to training stuff and online stuff. I've been trying to win online matches. I'm getting a bit better. But still a little way off to getting any more achievements on it.
Yeah, let's see if there... I don't think there was going to be a Dead or Alive 7. I honestly, that's kind of my feeling at the moment.
But the cliffhanger. Yeah. They brought back Helena's mother.
Yeah, but I just don't think it's going to happen, man. Like, the way that they unceremoniously kind of cut the tails off the season passes and stuff with that game, I just don't think it probably sold as well as it should have, and I don't think it's probably doing the numbers it would. I mean, it wasn't really at Evo or anything either the years it came out, so let's see.
I think it's a fantastic fighting game, and I think the Dead or Alive series does shine in its later installments even more so.
I like Dead or Alive. Honestly, it is one of those games that I I don't really like 3D fighting games, but I do actually like the whole high, middle, low system of Dead or Alive. I think that's a really
It's accessible. Cool way to do a fighting game. It's always looked good. Graphically, it's always looked really nice. And it's a shame if they don't continue it, because I'd love to see a Dead or Alive 7 on these next generation of consoles.
I think the most likely thing that you're going to get on this next generation of consoles is a Dead or Alive 6 resurrection or something like that, you know.
An ultimate.
Yeah, exactly.
Last round.
Exactly, the last round equivalent, where they perhaps introduce one new character, try and sell you all the same DLC again, and yeah.
Well, if I can play as Helena's mother, then I'm sold.
I'm glad, Tom. I'm glad.
Who's an opera singer, I think. So
she is an opera singer.
She'll be great in the ring. Yeah. I just wanted to get that in there because that's been long overdue, me finishing that.
So it goes. Like, this is the rate at which you finish games, Tom. No one who listens to this podcast is surprised, but it's okay.
But aren't we going to talk about directs and stuff?
Yeah, I think we should. We did tease it at the start.
We haven't touched on that.
Fortunately, I mean, even though this podcast is like 50 minutes long at this point, I don't really think, at least for me, there was that much to talk about, if I'm totally honest.
So which one are we talking about specifically right now?
Right. So within a whole week and a half, right, there was...
We'd had Nintendo, hadn't we?
We talked about Nintendo in length. There was some stuff at the Nintendo one. Sony came out with a State of Play, and admittedly, I watched it quite quickly. It wasn't very long. It was only about 15-20 minutes, right? I kind of skim watched it to see if there was anything new there, and obviously for me the big thing was the end announcement. But did anything catch your eye during that State of Play?
Well, I didn't watch it, so.
Ah, okay. Interesting.
But I try and keep up to date with headlines. What was the big one from that?
I can't recall. You're going to have to remind me. Fantasy, whatever it was. I can't even remember the name of it.
It was Final Fantasy. That's probably why I didn't pay much attention to it.
There was a million Final Fantasy announcements off the back of it, weirdly enough.
That's it. It's all getting very confusing, isn't it? The amount of spin-offs of 7.
Yeah, well, so they said Final Fantasy 7 Remake Intergrade will be out in the fall, I believe. It said autumn, which is essentially a PS5 only side story to Final Fantasy VII Remake that stars Yuffie, and it kind of deals with some of the stuff that's happening in her village that I can't remember the blinking name of, Wutai, and it was kind of alluded to in the original game that Wutai and I think Shinra, but it might just have been General Midgar, went to war because there was lots of raw material in Wutai. And so there was this huge war. And when you finally get...
Materia.
Yeah, materia, thank you. When you finally get to Wutai, you can kind of see that this land is relatively battle damaged. It's interesting to see that stuff actually like have more weight and more purpose. And I'd be very curious to see that. Final Fantasy VII Remake, unsurprisingly, looks very, very good on a PS5. There will be a free upgrade available if you purchased the original PS4 version.
Which you did.
I did. I own a physical copy. Are you glad, Tom Parry, that you didn't buy a physical copy? Because now you can play it for free on PlayStation Plus.
Yes. Well, I'm intrigued to try it, because I think I'd mentioned maybe on the podcast that I'd like to give that a go and properly experience Final Fantasy VII, but I have wondered whether or not I should play the original first.
There are schools of thought that would say you'd probably get something out of it if you did, but I would also argue you probably know the main beats of that story through cultural osmosis anyway, so I don't think you'd really need to.
I know the basic concept of the story.
Yes.
We're killing the planet.
Yes, the planet's dying.
We're over-mining it, the resources, the materia.
Yes, draining the Marco, the lifeblood of the planet from the life stream, Tom. And, I mean, Sephiroth also.
It's a good message. I mean, it's one that still rings true. I mean, it's a universally appreciated
issue. It is. So that was the state of play for me, to be honest with you. There were some
but what things. Also confuses me is, haven't we got like a downgrade of it coming out for mobile platforms?
Oh, right,
or
okay. So they're releasing a thing called Final Fantasy VII, I believe, Forever Crisis, which generally is probably more indicative of Square Enix, I think, at this point, and them needing to re-release Final Fantasy VII stuff every 6 months than it is of Final Fantasy VII. What it is essentially, it is a mobile
everything.
Game separate from Final Fantasy VII Remake, obviously, that chronicles every little bit of Final Fantasy VII. So from
Crisis Core,
from Crisis
Advent,
Core
Children.
Advent Children, Final Fantasy VII itself, Dirge of Cerberus, and
yeah.
Before Crisis, I think, was the mobile-only game, which has only ever been released in Japan. Which is interesting. It'll give people that story. It does also.
It looks kind of cool visually. It looks like it's like in between the PS1 original and this PS4 game.
Yeah, well, I mean, that, to be fair, that's kind of what the PSP games looked like, I think, for a lot of it. I mean, don't forget, half of this content is PSP or PS2. I mean, Advent Children is a film that they probably just downscaled, but I will play it. I'm very curious. The thing that also kind of took me for a loop, and I think probably even overshadowed a lot of the state of play stuff, was that they're making a Final Fantasy Battle Royale too. There's a
what's that one called?
It's called Final Fantasy VII: The First Soldier.
Okay.
And essentially, what that is essentially them saying, "Hey, before the Soldier program that produced Zack, Cloud, and Seth Roth, and all these other people." The Shinra needed to find candidates that were good enough to become soldiers, and so they dropped 100 of them on an island. I guess I don't know. I'll play it. I'll give it
for
a go.
Apex Legends. Yeah,
I'll give it a go. I don't know if it's going to be like first person shooter. I don't know if it's going to be a third person action game. I didn't really look at it. I just heard the headline Final Fantasy Battle Royale. I was like, okay, cool, sure.
Cloud uses a sword. Did he use that in the military or not?
I mean, soldiers generally use swords, so
that's the thing.
I imagine
okay.
It's going to be like a third. I imagine it's going to be a Musha Battle Royale, if I'm totally honest, but let's see.
Yeah, they're really milking Final Fantasy VII. It reminds me of a little what they were doing with. Was it. One of the older ones. Was it 13?
Yeah. But, I mean, 13, they never really milked to the level they've milked Final Fantasy VII.
Well, I mean, Lightning Returns.
Yeah, but that was
because
the whole point of it was supposed to be that it was a trilogy of games. Like, that was intentional. This is just like, oh, well, what if we made another Final Fantasy VII related game? Like, this is just them going back to the well too many times. But Final Fantasy VII does some interesting things with that universe that I'm like, okay, cool. If Final Fantasy VII
you
is
don't
going to
it.
Become your Marvel Cinematic Universe Square Enix, you go ahead. I'm there for it. It's fine.
Would that delay any sort of new Final Fantasy? No, actually, there is a new Final Fantasy, isn't there, coming out?
There is. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well. Okay. Fair enough. That's fine. So that was the state of play.
That
it was all
was
Final
state
Fantasy.
Of play.
There was
yes. And then there was a Pokemon Direct.
Yes. This was a little bit more interesting for me, personally.
Yeah, I would agree. The main highlights, there was obviously lots of stuff about like Pokemon Go updates and the Pokemon Cafe mix, mobile games and all this other stuff.
Yeah, that interests me less. Yeah.
But the main takeaways were obviously that they are remaking Pokemon Diamond and Pokemon Pearl. Which I'm not really that fussed about, if I'm being totally honest.
No, that's where I dropped off the series. Not to say it's a bad game. I have since gone back to it and played through it all. And, you know, it's all right. Yeah, just at that time in my life, I was sort of like, this is the same thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm just playing the same thing over and over again. So it's not my favourite. I actually think Black and White was better, but I'm not sure you're a fan of Black and White, are you?
I think Black and White's okay. I felt the same thing with Black and White as I did with Diamond and Pearl, to be honest. I bought Black and White when we moved to Denmark because it was a lot of us playing it. I had Diamond and Pearl when it came out because I won it in a competition prize, but I played a bit of it. I was like, I feel like I've done this before way too many times. Like I beat Pokemon Silver, Tom, like at least 4 times. I bought it. I had a ROM. I beat the English, like fan-translated ROM. Then I loved that so much and I spent so much time on it. I bought the Japanese version. Then I bought it when it came out in the US. I sold that and I bought a European copy eventually a couple of years later and played through it again. So that had happened. Emerald, I let Ruby and Sapphire come out and kind of ignored them. I bought Emerald because I saw it in a local video game store like weeks before it came out, an Australian copy. I was like, oh my God, this isn't even out yet. I'm going to buy this. So I did. And I played it and I enjoyed it, much to my girlfriend at the time's annoyance. And yeah, when Pearl and Diamond came out, I was like, oh, maybe I'll try this, but I don't know. Just too much other stuff going on in my life. It kind of came out in a period where, believe it or not, I wasn't really that interested in video games. Mm. And so it had to be a very good video game to grab me, and it just didn't do it.
So what are they calling these ones? They've got a little subtitle, haven't they? They've got an addition to the original name.
Brilliant Diamond. Brilliant Radiant Diamond. Pearl, I think.
Really, Radiant Ruby would have been much better back in the day when they released Ruby and Sapphire. I'm interested kind of to go back to old school Pokemon because I thought the last one, Sword and Shield, was too easy. I've said this on the podcast before. I've said as beautiful as it is, and the menus and everything for playing that game had been made so user friendly. I think Sword and Shield really achieved in the visuals and the user-friendliness of everything.
Yeah.
It was very good in that respect. But in terms of a challenging game, it was not that.
No.
So if we go back to Diamond and Pearl, there is still some challenge in that game. It's had a bit of a facelift. It doesn't seem too dissimilar from what it was before, which is interesting. So I'm not sure how I feel about that. But I guess it's the same thing as... what was it? Heart Gold and Soul Silver on the DS, as opposed to the original Game Boy version of those games. And I loved Soul Silver. That is for me still the best Pokemon game there ever has been. And if they can do those sort of improvements in these new versions of Diamond and Pearl, it could be a really solid, enjoyable old school Pokemon experience.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm kind of interested.
I never played Sword and Shield. I was on the fence anyway because people like you weren't here to play it with me. Otherwise, perhaps I would have been a bit more aboard the hype train. But when you told me you weren't really enjoying it and it was very easy, I was like, okay, I'm fine with this then. I'm not going to bother.
I still played it for 20 hours, but I haven't revisited it since.
Yeah, well, I mean, that kind of says it all, Tom. Like you said, you went back and played Pearl and Diamond and you weren't really that interested in them, so I don't know.
The other game looks far more interesting. That's the Pokemon Legends Arceus.
Arceus?
Arceus, yeah. I'm a little bit, you know, rusty on my Pokemon names, I have to say.
No, it's okay. Arceus is just a weird thing anyway. Arceus or whatever you pronounce it. Just cause
he's like a Pokemon who's like plain, but you give him different plates.
Yeah, but
then
he's like a Pokemon god also. Like, that's the weird thing to me is that he's... Yeah, I don't know. It's obviously seemed kind of weird. There's like a Pokemon god who created the universe and all this kind of stuff.
But the game itself now.
Yes.
That looks like a great concept. This is open world Pokemon.
It looks...
Which is what everyone's been screaming for years.
Yeah.
And now Pokemon Company, Game Freak, are delivering that game.
It looks like Breath of the Wild. And I am totally down for a third-person action RPG Pokemon game. It looked really cool from what they showed.
It showed you throwing balls without weakening the Pokemon, then saying, oh, you can have battles with wild Pokemon still as well.
Yeah.
In a way, it reminded me, I guess, of Let's Go...
Pikachu,
in terms of that mechanic, at least you throw it at them and you hope. I like that actually in Let's Go Pikachu and Eevee. So interesting to see that there. It did look a little rough around the edges, but it is a game that's in relatively early development. Yeah. It's not coming out till 2022, I don't think.
Yeah, if then, to be honest.
Yeah. So it's an ambitious project, but one that could really pay off. But they're not treating it as a main series game. It's a spin-off, isn't it? They're not saying the next Pokemon game's open world. So they seem to have made a very definite decision that this isn't the way Pokemon's going to go, but we're going to have this Legend series where we can actually go into that open world.
I think it lets them experiment. But you know what I mean? Like, if you think of a traditional Pokemon game and you think of how big a traditional Pokemon game is... I don't think a large open world Pokemon game, like a fully featured thing, would be achievable. It would be Breath of the Wild. We would literally be waiting like 10 years between Pokemon games if they were to move to that format. I think doing this, limiting the amount of Pokemon in it, setting it in a historical period so that perhaps there isn't that much infrastructure and all of this other stuff they have to make, is a very smart move to do, because it lets you explore that space, lets you see how people react to that without having to fully commit to doing a Pokemon game that might alienate your fans.
Yeah, it's set before everything that's been before, isn't it? Hasn't it?
I mean, the Pokemon
in the Sinnoh region,
like,
the same
weird
as
locks
the.
On them.
Yeah, it's interesting. It did look quite bare.
Yeah, I mean, it's an alpha. Also, like Breath of the Wild was quite bare, but there's a lot of stuff to do in that world, so I think they'll understand the challenge of that. Let's see. I don't think it'll be the whole Sinnoh region. I think it'll be an area or two.
No, that's interesting. I'd like to see something new done in the Pokemon universe. Also, I like seeing something old redone and looking at new Pokemon Snap.
Yeah,
that is very appealing to me.
I will gladly play a Pokemon Snap game. I hope it is longer than the original, but I'm totally down with a short Pokemon
I hope
Snap
it has
experience.
Gyroscope features. I hope you can use the Switch like a camera. That would be really excellent, I think.
Depends. Let's see. If it's on rails like the original is, then yes. If you are actually able to explore it,
it'll be on rails
a bit more. Then
it looks like it. No, I think the idea, it seems very natural if you're on rails and you do this. But then again, maybe you just have to press a button to look behind you.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't want to be putting the thing behind you and twisting all the way around. But if
I don't
want to
play
just,
Pokemon in a swivel chair.
No. If what's in front of you, you can kind of, you know, navigate with gyro controls, that's quite interesting.
Yeah.
And then maybe if you have like an action you can do to throw a ball and you move the Switch in a sort of.
Yeah.
I know you hate motion control, so you're not going to get excited about this.
I want to press a button and throw a Pokeball, Tom. I don't need.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that'll be there as well. But if you have the option, I think it'd be nice.
I'm sure
if that option
was there. I'm sure there will be motion controls because it's Nintendo and they love them.
They love them.
They love them.
So that was the Pokemon video. There was a really nice sort of, because it's celebrating 25 years this year, there was a lovely sort of overview of the whole franchise and how Pokemon games have innovated over the years too, which was cool to see.
Yeah. I liked that video. I thought it was very cool. That was the main bit I watched, and then I kind of skim-watched the rest of it. So,
yeah.
I liked that video. I thought that was cool. I like when Nintendo celebrates its own heritage and does all this other stuff. I think
Pokemon's
nice
been treated really well.
It's because Pokemon makes shit tons of money, though. Let's be honest. Like, there's a reason Pokemon's treated particularly well over some other franchises, because like Pokemon Go is still making billions. I did a community day yesterday, Tom, and they're at the point with Pokemon Go where I think they're running out of interesting things to do with the Pokemon that they have currently in the roster. Because, I mean, it was a fledgling community day, and I'm like, is there not a more interesting Pokemon than fledgling? Fuck's
sake. I can't even remember what fledgling looks like.
It's the little firebird that evolves into Talonflame.
Oh, that one.
It looks like a robin, if we're being totally honest.
Oh, that one. Okay. The Robin Pokemon.
Yeah, the Pidgey equivalent from Diamond and Pearl, I think. Maybe.
Ooh. Okay. Makes sense if it was Diamond and Pearl.
Yeah.
What do you think of the music concerts? Have you watched anything?
I haven't, no.
The Post Malone.
I definitely stayed away from the Post Malone one, but I haven't watched any of them, to be honest.
I don't think there's been any other ones. See, I think that's the only one that there's been so far. I thought it was all right. It was a little odd that, you know, some of the lyrics, I think he sang about sex at one point and Lugia was flying by, and that felt peculiar. But, you know, he mumbles a bit, so it's not always easy to hear what he's saying anyway.
I mean, Post Malone seems like a weird choice for the Pokemon thing for me anyway, but he's also one of the biggest artists in the world, so it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, it's kind of like pop music. I don't think the music's bad. I think it's kind of suitable in a way that it's kind of boppy and pop and kind of feel-good sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe some of the subject matter, what he was singing about, definitely doesn't correlate to the kind of Pokemon vibe you'd normally expect.
Well, I mean, I see... what you mean, but at the same time, I think you kind of can't, if you want to work with that artist, you've kind of got to work with that artist on their terms, right? You can't really go like, oh, well, no, you can't sing this song, which is clearly about
say no.
Popping pillies, yeah. I'm a rock star. I don't even know if that's thinking Post Malone, but
I don't know that.
You know what I mean? God, I'm showing my age by not knowing Post Malone songs, I think. But I don't really care.
I don't know him very well. He did collaborate with Ozzy on Ozzy's last album. That's how I was introduced to him. But
I listen to Danish radio when we drive places because our CD player's broken. So I've been exposed to my fair share of Post Malone songs. Not really my kind of thing. I don't really like mumble rap. So
yeah, mumble rap. That's great. That's I didn't know that was
the term. Yeah, for that genre. I don't know if it's a derogatory term for that kind of music, but that's how I've always heard it described as mumble rap. So
it's very fitting, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't watched any of that stuff. I have to be totally honest. I don't know. I'm sure I have an affinity for Pokemon music that if they were to do like a concert doing all the orchestral scores and stuff, I'd watch it in person, but I don't think I really want to listen to Post Malone do a song about Pokemon. That's not.
No, it's not about Pokemon.
No, I'm sure it wasn't.
It's about women and such.
Of course it was. Does he say, hey girl, let me have a Pikachu at any time during that song?
I wish he had of. That would have been quite humorous. No.
Okay.
No, he didn't.
That's a shame.
What a way to end the podcast, eh? I'm a bit of a bum note.
Not with a bang, but with a mumble.
With a mumble.
Never mind. So it goes. If you like this podcast, despite the extensive Post Malone coverage at the end, you can find us in a variety of places on facebook.com/TomMattAttack, on blastprocess.com, where you can also listen to the podcast, on Twitter @TMAcast, @GameBoyle for me, @TomParry11 for Tom. And there are a variety of other places you can listen to it, and TomMattAttack.com/podcast, on Stitcher, iTunes and Spotify. While you're there, want to give us a cheeky rate and subscribe, let us know you're listening. Tom, it's been a pleasure as always. I'm gonna go back and bang my head against Sekiro Wars for a little bit more before I probably uninstall that game, I think.
Oh, find out if Matt uninstalls Sekiro Wars next time on Tom Matt Attack.
Dum dum dum. Game on.
Game on.